In the sermon today, we will continue on with the subject that we've been covering, which is about the priesthood. So we are in the midst of four sermons about that subject, so two are down, so this will be the third one, and we'll have the final one next week. And so we'll be talking about the subject as it applies to the future, being a part of God's very family, and what our duties and responsibilities will be, which I thought would be nice in harmony with the upcoming feasts, and hopefully you'll find it profitable. And in the first sermon, we talked about God establishing a formal priesthood in Israel, focusing on Aaron and his family. In the second sermon, we talked about what is a priest and what does a priest do. And it's that's something that's relevant to all of us because it gives us an inkling of what we will be doing as we serve God in his kingdom, as a kingdom of priests. Today, in part three, it's going to be a more focused sermon, focused on a particular event, and it's a part of the story that's crucial for us to understand, and it helps us, hopefully we'll understand our destiny in the service to God. So we've examined God's establishment of the priesthood, and it's interestingly, once that priesthood was established, it wasn't too long before you had someone challenge it. And so if you establish something in a society, typically somebody's going to challenge it. Okay, we don't agree with that. We're not going to do it that way. And there's going to be a challenge of some kind. And sadly, there was a challenge to the priesthood after not too long after it was established. And basically, what happened was we could look at it as a lawsuit. A lawsuit was filed in order to challenge what had been established. And you might look at this challenge as the Roe versus Wade of the priesthood. And what God established in regard to the priesthood, it's interesting, it was established around 1440 BC, and it lasted all the way down to Ezra and Nehemiah's time. A very long period of time. You're looking at close to 700 years down to when Judah fell to Babylon, and then it starts again and then collapses completely once it became a political office for the priesthood. So we're going to put into the priesthood individuals who go along with our program as Alexander the Great or the Persians or whoever it might be. We're going to put priests in who will cooperate with our particular goal. And that's the way it was when Christ came, and the Romans basically appointed the priest. And they were all on the take, and it was just a corrupt system and needed to come to an end. So if you're going to file, and this is something that's common to us as Americans, and so I'll use the American circumstance to explain this. If you're going to file a lawsuit, then you have to have something called standing. Now, I'm going to explain it the best I can. If Mr. McKee were here, he might disagree with it to some degree, but hopefully it'll give you an idea of what standing is. So if you feel that you have been somehow injured, then you have grounds to file a lawsuit. And what a judge is going to do is you file that lawsuit, he's going to say, do you have standing? And he's going to examine whether you've been damaged or you've been hurt in some way, and that way there's actually something to judge. Now, if you're just filing a lawsuit because you don't like somebody or some other frivolous reason, then many times those suits get thrown out. So the judge is going to, the first thing he's going to examine is, do you, as the person filing the lawsuit, you would be the plaintiff, do you have standing? So you've been injured in some way, and therefore you have grounds to file a lawsuit. And so then I, as the judge, am going to determine whether you've really, truly been injured. And so that's the basis of American jurisprudence. You go to file a lawsuit, Anybody can file a lawsuit for anything. However, the judge is going to look at, is this legitimate? Do you really have standing? And there's a legitimate case to decide. So nearly 4,000 years have passed since the case in Numbers that we will examine, and the case will we will examine fits in nicely with the principles we've laid out in this definition of having standing. Did the people who filed the lawsuit we're going to look at have standing? And they did. They did. And so they filed that lawsuit. And then the person who is against whom you filed the lawsuit, he's called the defendant. So you have the plaintiff who says, I've been injured, I'm filing suit. And you have the defendant who, against whom the lawsuit is applied. So as you look at, so they're seeking to redress the issues that may have occurred here. So the case that we're going to look at is found in Numbers chapter 16. And in verses 1 and 2, we learn of the plaintiffs. Numbers chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. So here are the plaintiffs. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath. So Korah is from one of the three tribes of that are three families that are part of Levi. And then there are some other plaintiffs with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth. They were sons of Reuben. And they also were party to the suit, and they felt that they had been injured, so they're joining with Korah to file the suit. And then you have, then in verse 2 it says, and they rose up before Moses and some of the children of Israel. So they weren't the only ones who are the plaintiffs. There are others, 250 leaders of the congregation, princes of the assembly, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. So these are the plaintiffs that are laid out here in verses 1 and 2. So as we see, Korah was from the tribe of Levi. And when the formalized priesthood was established and Aaron was chosen to be the high priest, and then the Levites were chosen to serve Aaron, he felt that he had been injured, that his opportunity as a priest had been undermined, and so he was filing suit. Dathan, Abiram, and On were from the tribe of Reuben, the firstborn son of Jacob, and they felt that their rights had been infringed upon by the establishment of the priesthood. So our rights, our responsibilities have been taken away from us because of this formalized priesthood that's been established. And so the 250 princes of the congregation were heads of the patriarchal families, and they felt that they had been injured. So what you have is these 12 leaders of the 12 tribes, and under them you have tribal fathers within those tribal clans, and within those tribes you had tribal leaders. So you had all of these family members that are part of the 250, and they're part of the suit. So these 250 princes of the assembly felt that their rights had been infringed upon, and they were going to go to court, in essence, to resolve the issues. As we look at these things, let's first analyze a little bit more the 250 princes of the assembly. The 250 princes of the assembly who were gathered by Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On found that their charge resonated with them, that what Korah was accusing them of resonated with these princes of the assembly. It resonated with them, so they're going to file suit and join the suit. God was with God saying, I have chosen Aaron as my priest. I have given him the tribe of Levi to serve him. No other but the sons of Aaron are to serve me as priest, and you are not to offer anywhere except as my tabernacle. Moses is the person who is tasked with passing God's wishes along. And Moses is the first visible human.
Thank you.
Is the first visible human that is going to, that they would recognize, because he's the one that God spoke to. So he's the one who made the various decisions. And so he's got, they're the ones that they're focusing on. It was you who brought this all about, and they're blaming him for it, and therefore they're going to, he's going to be part of the suit as well. So Moses is seen in what took place by God's decision is that he was ending in one fell swoop a system that had been in place for centuries. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 6 and look at a few scriptures which give us an indication that this system of priesthood was not something new, but had been playing out in the history of the people of Israel for quite some time and was just the way it worked in Israel for many, many years. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, and let's go to chapter 8, verse 20. So Noah's been on the ark. The ark has come to rest on Mount Ararat, and the waters have receded, and now it's time for Noah and his family to come off the ark. So what does he do when he comes off the ark? What's the first thing he does? Genesis 8, verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. So what was Noah doing here when he built this altar? And what was he doing when he made sacrifice? He was serving as a priest. That was the function of a priest. And he made sacrifice of every clean animal and bird. So this took a while, all right? So he sacrificed one of each. Interestingly, you know, you might think about it, okay, he's sacrificing the giraffe just to take the giraffe and cut the giraffe up and do all the things you have to do with a sacrifice. That took a while in and of itself. So I don't think this was a couple of hour procedure. It took longer than that. But he made sacrifice as a priest is commonly does. So let's go to Genesis chapter 12, and we'll look at a person we're quite familiar with by the name of Abram at this point. And this, and we know Abram was asked to leave his country and go to a place that God would designate. And then God would make of him a blessed people and would give the childless couple, Abram and Sarah, would give them descendants to the extent that they would become a great nation. Not just one nation, but a multitude of nations. Abram took God up on his request to leave his city and move to where God would designate. And in Genesis chapter 12, after leaving his homeland and heading toward the land of Canaan, he arrived between the communities of Ai and Bethel. These are two cities in Canaan. And let's look at chapter 12 of Genesis, Genesis 12, verse 8. There it says, and he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So he built an altar and he called on the name of the Lord. So what is taking place here, he is serving a priestly function. The same as Noah. Noah was the head of his family, and as the head of his family, he served that priestly function. Abram was the head of his family, and he was carrying out this priestly function. So as I said, he built the altar, and if you're building an altar, you're going to do something with it, which was to make sacrifices, which he did. So he carried out this function, and it was a function that was going from one generation to the next. So Abram had a son by the name of Isaac, and he carried out the same function as his father Abram did, but we're going to look at Genesis chapter 46. So this was going from one generation to the other. So Isaac, like his father, Abraham, did make sacrifice to God. He built an altar and did the same. So then we come down to Jacob's generation, but we're going to look at Jacob in a little bit different way. Let's go to Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46. And we know that Jacob had 12 sons, and he became the father of 12 patriarchs, heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And let's look at Genesis chapter 46, verses 1 through 3. Genesis 46, verses 1 through 3. There it says, "So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac." So here we see Jacob carrying out the same function. "Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, 'Jacob, Jacob.' And he said, 'Here I am.' So he said, 'I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation.'" So Jacob continues the practice of making sacrifices. He's the head of his family and makes sacrifices for him. Now, when you look at, with that background, when you look at the 250 princes of the assembly that joined with Dathan, Abiram, and Korah, they did so on the basis that in a patriarchal society, it was the patriarch of the clan who was priest. It was the patriarch of the clan who was priest. So priesthood was the right of the clan leader of every one of those clans. Now, all of a sudden, upon arriving at Sinai, and with the declaration that Moses, from Moses' mouth, that God was making this decision, that he is having you trade your firstborn for the tribe of Levi, and from the tribe of Levi, he is taking the house of Aaron to be his priest. Then he is giving the tribe of Levi to serve the house of Aaron. And what God is doing here in one stroke is eliminating the rights of the head of the clan. So all these 250 princes of the congregation had been priests in their family. No longer do they have that position. So they felt that they had been wronged, and they became plaintiffs with Korah's suit. And the fact that their job had been done away with by the appointment of God, they disagreed with that. And really, they looked on Moses as the cause of this. "You're the one who told us about this, so you're the one that brought this all about." So they're suing Moses as the person that's there on serving on God's behalf. So as we go back, before we read the case, we by nature, unless we are doing an in-depth study, we tend to be surface readers. We read over things. How many of you have gone back and reread a passage of Scripture that you didn't realize there was anything in there deeper to see? And somebody brings it up and you think, "Well, I never noticed that." I mean, I think every one of us has, which is kind of an exciting thing. Well, how could I miss that? It's so obvious. But that's the way it is. You know, we read over it and we really don't stop to think about the implications. So somebody points it out, then we begin to dig. That's how we tend to be. Now, we're all part of a church culture. And I'm going to talk about a part of church culture which I didn't really think about, although I was heavily involved in this particular issue before I came in the church. But I really didn't stop to think about it much. But this particular issue is something that used to be more commonly mentioned than it is now. When I started going to Ambassador College, I heard a lot about it. So anyway, I heard a lot about it, and it's something that we begin to recognize as we come to repentance and we turn to God, and it begins to diminish as an issue because we see there's a right way and a wrong way to live. And the issue that we're talking about is bad attitude. How many of you have ever heard in the church, "bad attitude"? You have a bad attitude. So we don't hear so much about that but bad attitudes continue to exist, even though we don't address it as much as we used to. But the bad attitude was the excuse for reprimanding any and everyone. So if somebody brought up an issue and we didn't like it, they're, I don't like your attitude. So we would use that as a way to beat back somebody who is questioning us. That probably was not, for sure, was not the right approach. But anyway, bad attitude is something that we thought we were quite familiar with. And it, once we came into the church and God began to work with us, then we became more cognizant of a bad attitude, hopefully our own. And I know that my attitude was bad a lot. I know that one of my fellow students told me after I had moved on from the college in Big Sandy, he said, you know, you had the worst attitude of anybody I've ever seen at Ambassador College. And I thought, you know, and by that point in time, you know, I'd been baptized and God's Spirit was at least working a little in my life, and I recognized, you're right. I didn't fight him on it. I just thought, I'm sorry that you had to put up with all that. And my bad attitude predated the church, and I feel sad for my parents. So anyway, I did not do well on that front. If I didn't get my way, I was unhappy and made everybody else unhappy too, or attempted to. But, you know, that's something that's part of life that we have to recognize and then deal with. And that particular problem is something that shows up here in this lawsuit. It's not just a matter of the details that they're worried about or working on. It's that there's a great deal of a wrong attitude that's part of what's unfolding here. So, you know, we as Christians have become highly sensitized to that. So anyway, we see that this bad attitude is a part of the lawsuit that's being filed. So we as Christians should be attuned to that. We have to look at attitude sometimes because it is part of what's going on. So I know that, you know, as we are kids, and if you have children, have any of you ever recognized that your child has not had a good attitude? I mean, we all have. You know, and so as they don't have a good attitude, then we have to say, you know what, you need to take a break from playing with the other kids here and sit down and think things over for a while. So when your attitude improves, then you're going to be able to go back to playing with the kids. We all have gone through that. I've gone through that. And it's something that you as a parent recognize shows up from time to time. So we're looking at a case where the plaintiffs have bad attitudes. That's part of what's going on here. It's not just the legalities and the questioning the legalities, it's that they have a bad attitude. As a result, a casual reader of number 16, we can miss this, but it is fundamental to what's going on. And we all know this as parents, and we realize that, you know, as this case is being brought forward, you know, Moses can't just say, you know, your attitudes stink, so we're not even going to consider your complaint until your attitudes improve. So that issue was not brought up, but it was part of the of what's going on here. But Moses did not turn down their case just because they had bad attitudes. Because they had some legitimate questions which could have been answered, but sometimes when your attitude's not good, you're already heading in the wrong direction, and unless the decision is in your favor, you're going to continue to have a bad attitude, and it's going to probably get worse. That's how bad attitude tends to work. So they brought their case, and not only did they bring their case, they also brought a bad attitude. So we're dealing with a situation where we are already of what the name Korah represents. Throughout my time in the church, Korah is the example of a bad attitude. And he's the epitome of that. And usually if you want to condemn somebody that disagrees, they have a bad attitude, and immediately you know what the accusation is and where they're coming from. So Korah equals bad attitude. And right now, that's not the issue that is going to be dealt with. The case is the issue. So we've already made the point that the 250 princes of the assembly have standing. So they have a right to bring a case. They have been injured, or at least they feel they have, and so let's hear the case. Let's hear what they have to present. So what was the case that was brought forward? The case, interestingly, is succinctly laid out for us in one verse. The 250 princes, the Reubenites, and one Levite stood before Moses and Aaron and said, in Numbers 16, verse 3 lays out what the case is in a very succinct manner. So let's read Numbers 16, verse 3. It says, they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. So who are Moses and Aaron? They are the defendants. They are the defendants. And said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? And part of their bad attitude is made worse by the translation here from the Kyle and DeLitch Old Testament commentary. We read from our Bibles, you take too much upon yourselves. More properly, this should be translated in the Hebrew, enough for you. And you probably think, well, what does that mean? Because it doesn't fully explain what they're saying. They said to Moses and Aaron, enough for you, that is, let the past suffice. That is, you have served as the leader of Israel. You and Aaron have served as the leaders of Israel from the time God began to work with Pharaoh in leading us out of the land, in leading us through the Red Sea, in taking us to the Mount Sinai and the God speaking to us the Ten Commandments. You've been through all those things. And that's all well and good. You did a good job. But you know what? Your time is over. And it's time for somebody else to take over, because we're all holy. We're all holy. I guess my question would be, if we're all holy, then why are you in charge? And it's not somebody else from the tribe of Ephraim, or why is that? Well, why are you the exalted one? So anyway, they said, you've had enough. It's now time for your rule over the people of Israel to come to an end, and we're all holy, so we need to make a change here. So they accuse Aaron and Moses of lifting themselves up above the congregation, which, if you've read the story, that wasn't happening. Did Moses chomp at the bit to be in charge? If you go back to the situation with the burning bush, nah, Moses did his best to get out of it, didn't he? I can't speak well, so I shouldn't go and take on this responsibility. So he was trying to get out of it. But God said, quit complaining, quit whining, you're in charge, and I'm with you. And if you can't speak, you've got a brother, Aaron, who will speak for you. But you're the man. So Moses went and did what God told him to do. And as you look at the scenario as it played out, as they began to come out of Egypt and all of the things that God worked out, Moses was the one that God worked with. All the way through the process, every step of the way, he's the one that God worked with. And he was still the one that God was working with, and there's no indication that God was displacing Moses and establishing a new leader. So they said to Moses, you and Aaron have done enough. Your time is finished. Pass on the baton. So this was the case. It's time for you guys to retire, step back, and let some new blood step in. So their case goes back to a scripture that will be at the heart and core of next week's sermon. because the scripture they're citing as the basis for their case is repeated in the future. So they cited Exodus 19 as the basis of their case. They cited Exodus 19 as the basis of their case. They could say to Moses justifiably, "You, Moses, are the one who told us this. You're the one who passed this information along from God." And Exodus 19, verse 3, is where God passes on his message about the people of Israel. Exodus 19, verse 3, it says, "And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will be indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So these were words that God spoke to the people of Israel. But in speaking those words, he did not remove Moses. He did not make that change. But that was God's intention for the people of Israel. And this particular verse in Exodus chapter 19 is quoted by the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. So this was something that God set up for Israel, and then God repeats it through the Apostle Peter to designate those whom he would call into the church. The members of the church would be his designated priest, and they are to be a part of God's kingdom and serve in that capacity, to be a kingdom of priests. Peter says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." So just as God called Israel out of Egypt and they were going to be a kingdom of priests, he's called us out of the world, led us to repentance, and he's given us his spirit, and we are to be his chosen people, a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. And then in chapter 5, verse 8, he emphasizes this again. Revelation chapter 5, verse 8, he says, "Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb of God, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints, and they sang a new song." They sang a new song, saying, "You, that is Jesus Christ, are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation." So just as God called the tribes of Israel out of Egypt, God called us out of this world from different peoples, different nations, not just from Israel. It says, and in verse 10, "And have made us kings and priests, or a kingdom of priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." That's our future. That's what we're going to be doing. That's what we're going to be part of. So as you think about this, what pertinence does this have to me? It has a lot of pertinence because it's telling you in type what is to come. So this situation of a kingdom of priests is a very significant issue, and it was the core of Korah's case. And basically they're telling Moses, "You and Aaron have been here long enough. It's time for you to step aside so we can step into your position, and because the whole kingdom is a kingdom of priests. The whole nation is a kingdom of priests." So the plaintiffs, Korah, the Reubenites, and the 250 princes of the assembly said, "The entirety of the nation of Israel are kings and priests." And this was the case that they brought before Moses. So here was a case that's pitting two decrees against each other. One was a formal assignment of Aaron and his family to the priesthood. So that's one part of the case. They were formally given the opportunity to serve as priests before God. The other was a statement at the bottom of Mount Sinai, stating that Israel could become a kingdom of priests. So you have these two seemingly opposing ideas, and as they're putting their case forward, they're basically saying we all have that right to be priest before God. So we have these two key elements, and first to consider, all of this was addressed to Moses, and Moses quickly recused himself because the plaintiffs sought to put Moses into a position where he was both defendant and judge. And, you know, if you're going to judge fairly, you can't be the defendant and the judge. So he recused himself from judging the case, and who's going to judge the case? God is. God is going to judge it. Now, Moses did give an opinion, and he wasn't bashful about it, but his opinion is not a judicial judgment, but he did give an opinion. God was to be the judge, as I said, and this takes us back to something we addressed earlier, and now becomes highly relevant in this case. Remember, we talked about attitude. And so Moses wasn't judging their attitude, although he did note it. God most definitely is. God is most definitely quite well aware of the attitude that's behind this suit. So God does judge right and wrong, and he does take attitude into consideration. So, you know, as you can look at, you may be right, but if your attitude is not good, then you can lose out because your attitude is not good. So just because you're right doesn't mean the case is going to go your way, because that's going to be part of the judgment. So the 250 princes of the assembly had just lost the right to be the priest of their own families and to offer sacrifices where and whenever they chose to do so. So they were not happy. We have been hurt by this decision. Dathan, Abiram, and On were smarting over a loss that was centuries old. And they've been told, you're no longer to serve as priest. You're no longer to serve as priest for the tribe of Reuben. Genesis chapter 49 speaks of the 12 sons of Jacob. Their dad was a firstborn, and as you look at his sons, one of them was a firstborn, and we'll see that here shortly. Let's go to Genesis chapter 49 and look at verse 1. So this is a prophetic, and Jacob is speaking to his sons, or Israel is speaking to his sons, and telling them what's going to come to pass at the end of the age. And it's interesting what he makes note of. And let's begin in Genesis chapter 49, verse 1. It says, "And Jacob called his sons and said, 'Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days.'" So this is prophetic, what he's saying. He starts with his first son, Reuben. In the beginning of the verse, he says positive things. He's complimentary. Genesis 49, verse 4. He says, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." And as a firstborn, to defile your father's couch is basically to cause you to be disqualified as the firstborn. So God earlier had designated who the firstborn was to be. In Genesis chapter 48, he spells that out. And he's adopting Joseph's two sons. And so he's going to bless them, and he's going to establish them as part of the 12. And it says in Genesis chapter 48, or verse 5, and now your two sons, Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt that before I came to Egypt, are mine. They are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. So he's making a rather momentous decision here. And what is he saying? He's saying, I have adopted two of my grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh, and my two grandchildren are going to hold the positions that formerly belonged to Reuben and Simeon. They belong to Reuben and Simeon. And this is why Dathan, Abiram, and On were plaintiffs in the case, because they were no longer the priest of their family. Their rights, their privileges had been taken away. So Korah's attitude was a little more complicated. As you think about it, there were three tribes of Levi, and the most privileged of the three was the family of Kohath. And Kohath had four sons, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel. So Moses and Aaron were children of Amram. Amram was the firstborn of Levi, and they were his sons. So their being the sons of Amram gave them a prominent position, a superior station that was in harmony with the birth order. Korah was a son of Izhar, the secondborn son. And yet, it's interesting how assignments were made. Korah was basically telling Aaron and Moses, we are as good as you are. We're all from the same family. In fact, even from the same clan within the family. And what was the probable rub for Korah? When God was giving out assignments, he passed over Korah and his family and went to the last-born son, Uzziel, and designated him for certain privileges and responsibility. So you already had Korah, who was a climber, a person who wanted to get ahead. So what happens with a climber when you're passed over? I'm next up. I should get the goodies. And then you don't get them, and they go on to the fourth-born son. This is not fair. This is wrong. And Korah noted that. And as a result of that, he was not a happy camper either, and he was very unhappy with Moses and had a very poor attitude as he came before Moses. So he noticed that he had been slighted, that he had not been given what he deserved. And you remember when the priesthood was established, Aaron had four sons, Nadab and Abihu. Instead of listening to God and respecting their role, they chose to do their things, the things that of the priesthood their own way. And God said, sorry, I'm not going to tolerate that. And he killed them both. And in the shock of all this, with Aaron having lost two sons who were basically incinerated, how did God clean up the mess? Well, he chose that youngest son, the family of the youngest son, to clean up the mess. He passed over Korah and his family. And this was just another slight, that the baby brother would be chosen over Korah's family. So all of this contributed to Korah having a bad attitude. And you know, if you think back to your bad attitude and my bad attitude, how did it come about? Usually it was because we didn't get what we wanted. We didn't get what we wanted, or it didn't work out the way we wanted. So what else could we do but be angry about it, stew on it, and eventually have a bad attitude? And that was Korah's problem. So as you look at this, we have a specific set of statements where God said, this is the family I want to be the priest. He designated Aaron, his sons, and the particular tribe, and the tribe of Levi. They all had certain responsibilities. And as far as the priesthood, it was Aaron and his sons. And he didn't pick any of the rest of them for that responsibility. But prior to all that, at the base of Mount Sinai, God had made a general statement. Hey, look, you're all going to be priests, a kingdom of priests. So then you have Aaron and his family, his boys, being made priests. And then you have this statement at Mount Sinai that says you're all going to be priests, which they had difficulty with. So which one was a very specific statement about Aaron and his family being priests, and the other was a general statement about the whole nation being a kingdom of priests. So Korah is pleading that the general statement takes precedence, and Moses is pleading that the specific is what we have to look to. So this was the case that was brought before God, Korah saying, we are all priests, and Moses saying, no, Aaron and his sons are the priests. So Moses made a proposal of how to resolve this, and everybody agreed with the proposal. So Moses selected a particular function that a priest would carry out as he's carrying out the duties and responsibilities of a priest, and that is having an incense burner and putting incense on the burner and going before God. So he said, what we're going to do is everybody that's involved in this case, go get a censer, bring the censer, you know, put fire in the censer, put incense on it, and come before God. And then God will make a decision. So everybody said, sounds good to me. And everybody said, we'll go through with that. So as you start thinking about that, you have 256 individuals who are going to have censers and incense and the fire to put on that. So where did they get 250 censers? You may not think about this, but they had to come from somewhere. They did not go to the Walmart. Okay, let's all go down to Walmart and we'll get a censer. That's not what happened. They had all been priests, and as priests, they all had a censer. So they got their censer out as they were used to using it, and brought it to before God with the incense and the fire in it and the smoke that would waft up from it. Number 16, verse 4. So in Moses, so they're coming here and they're going to present their case. And Moses, when he heard, let's look at chapter 16, verse 4. Number 16, verse 4. Because it's interesting how Moses reacts. Number 16, verse 4. And it says in verse 4, so when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. So he saw what they were up to and he fell on his face because he realized the attitude's bad and what you're doing here is pushing the bounds. Pushing the bounds. So he fell on his face because he detected attitude. Verse 5, and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near him. That one whom he chooses he will cause to come near him. Do this. Take your censers, Korah and all your company. Put fire in them and put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the Holy One. So he says this to the people bringing the case, and then he takes a parting shot. He takes a parting shot, and he says to them, you take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. The contemporary English version says of that, Korah, this time you Levites have gone too far. You've gone too far. Chapter 16, verse 16. It says, and Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and your company be present before the Lord, you and they as well as Aaron. Let each take his censer and put incense in it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer. So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. So they're all standing there. They all have their censers, and all of this smoke is rising up from the incense. So you have 260 of the plaintiffs lined up. And as you look at this, one of the interesting things is, remember, On of the tribe of Reuben was mentioned when the case was first brought forward. But as you look at this, On wasn't there. On was not there at this point. So the question is, what happened to On? It is likely that On stood back and thought, I don't think I want to do this. So I'm going to withdraw. I'm going to no longer be a plaintiff in this case. And On is never mentioned again, but he's not there as this is all unfolding. So he said, you know, he must have, you know, reality must have kicked in. I don't think this is going to go well. So I'm going to withdraw my part in this case. So he went on and lived a peaceful, joyous life among the people of Israel, but he was not going to press this forward. So the other guys didn't wise up, and they went ahead with the case. And then Korah introduces something new to the case as this is coming to a final conclusion. He's introduced something that is a new twist to it. And let's go to Number 16, verse 19. And this is just indicative of how far wrong this has gone. Number 16, verse 19. It says, "And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation." So what did Korah do? He stirred up the whole congregation. He was a divisive force in the congregation and stirred all of them to come forward and join in the case. So what were they trying to do? Something that's commonly done today. They were seeking to try this case in the court of public opinion. And you know, with God, I don't care how many people you have here. I'm going to decide what is right. So even though the whole of Israel was there, it had no sway with God. As you'll see here in a moment, it had no sway at all. So instead of Korah, a couple of Reubenites, and 250 princes of the congregation, we have Korah, a couple of Reubenites, and 250 princes of the congregation, and the whole congregation of Israel is saying, "Attaboy, Korah, go get him." Number 16, verse 20, we see God's reaction. "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment.'" So God said, enough of this. And he's going to wipe them out. He's going to wipe out all these people that have brought the case and all the people of Israel that are backing them up in the case. So God told Moses and Aaron to gather their wives, children, family, and distance themselves from the plaintiffs. Why was that? Because God says that he's going to destroy them all. So, and really, as you look at it, the person they've been attacking is Moses. And Moses could say, you know what? They deserve it. Go ahead and fry them. But Moses was not that kind of person. That's why he was like our Savior Jesus Christ. He was a type of Jesus Christ, and he fell on his face and said, "God, please spare them. Have mercy on them." Not because they deserved it, but Moses was willing to intercede for them with God. So God was willing to hear his plea, not because the people of Israel deserved it, but because this intercessor, this human being who led Israel, was willing to step into the breach for them. And you might think, and so that is what saved the people of Israel. And that's the kind of leadership that is needed in God's kingdom. People who will stand up for what's right. People who will intervene for people who are oppressed and serve them. So Moses stands up for the congregation and then and God listens to him. Tells him to get away from Korah, Dathan, and Abiram in chapter 16, verse 24. And then in verse 25, then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. So they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doors of their tents and with their wives, their sons, and their little children. They didn't recognize what was going on. They could see all these people withdrawing from them. That should have been a sign, oops, this may not be going our way. But they didn't recognize it, and they stand there looking out on the congregation. Numbers 16, verse 28, Moses said, by this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have done them, I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally, like all men, or if they are visited by common fate of men, then the Lord has not sent me. So with this case presented to God, it was now time for God to make a judgment. So God did make that judgment. And what did he do? With Korah and his family, he opened up the ground. Something new took place. You know, the ground opened up, and in fell Korah and his family into the abyss. And then the ground closed back up. No more Korah, no more family. So God destroyed them all. The earth swallowed them up. And the people saw this, and they were very much afraid. So they saw all of this, and it's interesting, the people got back because they did not want that same fate that took place with Korah and his family. And then you had the other plaintiffs in the case, the 250 who were also a part of this, and what happened to them? In chapter 16, verse 35, it says, and a fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. So you had 250 men who were part of the case, basically incinerated. God said those men took those censers and used them in a holy fashion. So then he said, gather those censers, and I want you to beat them into a piece that will be put around the perimeter of the altar. I want this to be a part of the altar that is holy to me. So you have a nation that was absolutely stunned by what took place here. And, you know, just like all of us probably on 9/11 who were watching and noting what was taking place there, it was amazing. We as Americans had never seen anything like it. It was just stunning to see what took place there as those buildings fell. Those planes flew into them, and these people of Israel were stunned as well. They didn't know how to take this. But they went to bed that night, they slept on it, and by the time they awakened the next day, they were on the wrong side of the bed. And they said, hey, look, you've killed the people of Israel. Basically, they were very unhappy. You've killed the people of the Lord, it says in chapter 16, verse 41. And who is you? You, Moses and Aaron. So God detected the attitude of the people of Israel and said to Moses a second time, get out of the way, because I'm going to destroy them. Okay, I've spared them once, but they're right back to the same attitude and approach. I'm going to destroy them. So, Numbers 16, verse 44, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from among this congregation that I may consume them in a moment. And what did Moses and Aaron do once again? They bowed down before God. They bowed down before God. They fell on their faces and pled for the plaintiffs. So, so God said, well, I'm going to pour out a plague on the people of Israel. And so Moses said to Aaron, take a censer and put fire in it from the altar, put incense on it, and take it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun. So Aaron got a censer. He put the the fire in the censer and put the incense on it, and he ran toward the people who were suffering from the plague. And by his by his intervention, the plague was stopped. There were 14,700 who died in the plague, but Aaron, by his quick action, did save them. So Moses and Aaron, they did save them. So with this incident completed, Israel stopped muttering. They stopped muttering. And God said, I'm not finished. I'm not finished because, you guys haven't gotten it up to this point. What's taken place should have been very convincing, but I don't think you guys get it. So we're going to drive the point home beyond the shadow of a doubt. So we're not going to read chapter 17 of Numbers because it explains what took place. But what God had Moses do was gather all of the rods that represented the authority of the head of each of the tribes. So they each had a rod, just like Moses had a rod. They had a rod that represented their authority. And as you look at how things could play out, those individuals that had that rod could claim, we're next in line. We should be the priest of our family. And God said, not so. We're going to solve this once and for all. So he said, gather the rods from each family. Gather the rods from each family. And here's what God said. He said, I want you to bring me a leader's staff from every tribe in the nation. Put the name of the tribal leader on each staff. Then I want you to bring Aaron's staff with his name on it. Not the tribal name, but his name on it. Korah had already, and you know, this is all in light of the mess that Korah had made. And God is basically saying, I want all the staffs brought to the tabernacle. So they brought all the staffs to the tabernacle. Chapter 17, verse 6. So Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and each of the leaders gave him a rod apiece for each leader according to their father's houses. 12 rods, and the rod of Aaron was among the rods. And Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. Verse 8. Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And the Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony, to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die. Thus Moses did just as the Lord had commanded him. So he did. So the children of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, surely we die. They thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble here. Surely we die. They realized that God was basically not going to put up with any of the rebellion again. So you think about bringing the rods of the leaders of the tribes of Israel before God, what was the point? Since the princes were the oldest sons, God drove the point home. It didn't matter if you were the oldest son in a particular family. I have chosen Aaron, and I have chosen his sons to be my priest. And yes, you may have had that duty and responsibility for hundreds of years, but when I change things, this is the way it's going to be. I think at that point they probably, well, let's not push this anymore. So we may get away with our lives here. So God made this clear to them, and this procedure forever settled the matter of priesthood in Israel. Who was God's priest? Aaron and his descendants. That's the way God established it, and that's the way it was all the way down to the time when Israel fell to the Babylonians, and then it was reestablished for a short time and then went away for good. So I think we can see from Exodus 19, 1 Peter chapter 2, Revelation 1 and 5, that God is preparing us to be a kingdom of priests. That's what he's setting us apart for. That's what he's preparing us for. So we as God's people have as our next step, following the blast of the seventh trump, the opportunity to be younger siblings of Jesus Christ, part of God's family, to be part of the leadership of his kingdom. So what are we going to do? Are we not a kingdom of priests? If we are, then what is our job? We'll talk about that next week. So hopefully you found that profitable, and we'll look forward to finishing up next week, and since we're coming up upon the feast and what it represents, so it should give us something to think about and rejoice in as God is setting up what's going to play out in the kingdom of God. So thanks everybody for your attention, and we'll look forward to fellowshipping after services, and we'll see you all next week.